listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's been a surge of interest in home remodeling over the last year. A retail expert digs into the big business of home improvement, and you could share your shopping experiences. Now, Wisconsin had its first wolf hunt in several years a few months ago, and state officials are starting to take feedback on how it went. Some in the state are upset because state-licensed hunters went over the quota, harvesting nearly double the number they were allotted. But other hunters say the just over 200 wolves killed were in line with the state's goals overall, arguing the wolf population won't be hurt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you participate in the February wolf hunt? If so, how did it go? Do you think there should be another wolf hunt this fall? If you've been following this issue, how do you think the state should determine the right number of wolves and whether to allow a wolf hunt in the first place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. George Meyer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. He's the former secretary of the state's Department of Natural Resources. George, welcome back to the show.
Good to talk to you again, Rob.
Well, George, the fundamental issue here in a lot of ways is, what is the right wolf population for Wisconsin? Can you talk about some of the factors that go into figuring out what the right number, or I guess range of numbers, should be?
Well, there's really, I would say, about three different factors. One is the long-term trend of how healthy the wolves are in the state in terms of reacting to temperatures and weather conditions, their food, any diseases or whatever. And from that standpoint, the Wisconsin wolf population is very healthy and significantly growing population. But in terms of what is the right number long term, there's really two factors. One is the what's called a biological carrying capacity, and that is what is the habitat available to wolves, and is there enough habitat for the population, or is there are you starting to run out of quality habitat? Well, in this state, there is significant habitat for wolves, and you've seen the population grow dramatically. The other constraint, and this is the one that gets controversial, is what is the social carrying capacity? And virtually every species ends up having to be discussed in terms of what the social carrying capacity is. In other words, what impact in interactions are there between humans and species? And that's true for deer populations, auto accidents, crop damage. It is for bear populations, nuisances caused by bear, et cetera. Well, there also is a social carrying capacity for the gray wolf in this state. And at least right now, it's more viewed in terms of what is its impact on agriculture, and not agriculture necessarily across the whole territory, but in individual farms and regions that have wolf populations. In addition, what impact is it having on other human uses, whether it's hunting dogs, pets, horses, pets, and even to some extent, what are its interactions with humans out hiking or whatever? And Wisconsin over the last many years has put down packs because they've become too comfortable and start tracking and following humans. So there's this combination of general health of the population, the biological carrying capacity, and the social carrying capacity. And the controversial one is always the social.
Now, George, we had this hunt in February. It was kind of back and forth on whether it was going to happen then at all or whether a hunt would wait till the fall. A target was set. Hunters got over it as it was sort of being called off because the numbers were being hit. As you look back at that February hunt, what do you make of how it went?
Well, it was a poorly planned hunt from the start. At this time, our spring of last year, the Secretary of Interior said the wolf was going to be delisted at the end of the year. And while that wasn't a final decision, there should have been contingency planning with the stakeholders about how that season should be planned, including the required consultation with the tribes. And the end of the year meant it was going to open up in the middle of the statutorily required season. Well, that planning wasn't done, and then a lawsuit was filed, and not surprisingly, the judge ruled against the department. And then the second problem occurred. I personally believe that the permit ratio set by DNR staff at 10 to 1 was too many permits even for the hunt, because that was based on the earlier seasons, which did not have much hunting with dogs, which is extremely fast and a rapid way of harvest. And then compounding it is the Natural Resources Board, without any background in science, doubled the number of permits from 10 to 1 to 20 to 1. So it was no surprise to people familiar with this that there was going to be a very rapid harvest and one that could not be controlled by the 24-hour notice period, which did work in the seasons in 2012, 2013, 2014. But there was no way that the 24-hour notice would have stopped the overharvest that took place.
Talking to George Meyer, executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, former secretary of the state's DNR, looking at the wolf hunt we had in the state in February, another one possible in the fall. The DNR now looking back at how that hunt went and forward to see if a hunt's going to happen, what the numbers should be in that hunt. And George, concerns raised now because those numbers were exceeded during, as I understand, wolf breeding season. There are concerns that the numbers taken would damage the overall population. I know others saying, nope, our numbers are still pretty strong. What do you look at there?
Well, you have to distinguish between what the quota was, which was 119 for the state, and that is what the state permit should have limited to. You had the tribal number, but the total allowed, or the population, DNR had calculated the total 200 as not having a substantial adverse effect long term on the population. And one thing people have to keep in mind, this population is growing. It's not static. Last year, the population actually grew 13%. So while it clearly was over the quota, I do believe that, in fact, it will not have any significant adverse long-term impact on the population. What it should dictate, though, I believe personally, is that any fall hunt should have a relatively conservative number compared to what otherwise it would have if there had not been this harvest earlier this year.
And you mentioned that 10 to 1 ratio turning into 21. I want to make sure I have this right, George. That means the number of permits issued as a ratio to the number of wolves that the DNR actually wants to see taken. Do I have that right?
That is correct. And they said 10 to 1. That was probably too high a number, as I indicated. But it was not nearly as severe an excess as the 20 to 1 that the Natural Resources Board jumped to without a staff recommendation or any science.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in Brookfield. Gary, hi.
Hi. Hey, George, I wanted to make mention of a fact that I saw in the Outdoor News just recently, and I wonder if you can confirm it. It said that Wisconsin has the second highest population of wolves of any state in the U.S., the highest being Minnesota, and that Wisconsin had approximately four times as many wolves as the state of Wyoming, and that's inclusive of all the wolves that people go to watch in Yellowstone.
Those
Do you believe
are
that's an
numbers.
Accurate figure?
Those are correct numbers. The Wisconsin does have a very high population of wolves. And, one of the concerns is, and especially as the wolves are moving south, we're starting to get more interactions with citizens and farmers and whatever. So that's where that social caring capacity comes into play, and there needs to be management, professional management, to assure that there can be a tolerable number of wolves in the state, considering the impacts they can have on especially agriculture and other human interactions.
Thanks for that call. And my producer mentions that's of the lower 48. Alaska would have more wolves, substantially more than any other state. Talking to George Meyer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, with us today to talk about the future of Wisconsin's wolf hunt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want the wolf hunt to look like in Wisconsin in the future? Are you against having one at all? If you're a member of a tribal group, what do wolves mean to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about Wisconsin's wolf hunt with George Meyer, former Secretary of the State DNR, current head of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions about gray wolves in Wisconsin and the recently reinstated hunting season for them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Lexi is with us in Elkhorn. Lexi, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering if the guests knew what the population of wolves was before pre-European contact and colonization. So what would it be before human settlement all over Wisconsin? And cougars, too, if he knows anything about that. So if we're talking about how big the population is now, what would it be without humans here? And how did that impact the wildlife and benefit deer herd populations and other wildlife populations?
Lexi, thanks for that call. So, Lexi, wondering what we know about the time before European settlement when Native Americans were the only people here, George.
I don't know what that population was. And, probably are estimates out there and judgments. The one thing to keep in mind is if you're looking at Wisconsin pre-settlement would have substantially more wolf habitat than it does now. I mean, there's stories, and I think by the history of where I grew up in New Holstein and Kahneman County, when the settlers got there, there were wolves, and clearly it's an area that doesn't have any wolves today. And, throughout the state, there would have been a wolf range. So I think it'd be very hard to compare. I know that, in fact, the estimates, I can't give numbers, that the deer population in this country is estimated to be higher now than pre-settlement. But I would not know clearly that would be the case for wolves also, but I can't give a precise number, and there may be one, but I do not know where it is.
Thanks a lot for the call, Lexi. And George, I know part of the story here is wolves as predators of deer. And I've seen arguments, hey, we need more wolves to act as a natural predator for the deer herd to keep it from getting out of control. I know that's an issue for hunters sometimes who want people to be the main predators, in effect, of deer. How do you balance that out?
The major way of managing the deer herd and keeping the population down clearly is through hunting, just by sheer numbers of the individuals that are out hunting over 500,000. That is the major method to keep the deer herd in within its habitat numbers. Clearly, wolves do have an impact on deer population. On the total wide population, it's a relatively small impact. Where it has an impact as far as hunting is, if you have a traditional hunting area, maybe where you've hunted for years or your family did, there's a deer camp or it's a farm or whatever, if you have a wolf pack nearby, that's going to negatively have an impact on your hunting experience. But in terms of the total impact on deer populations, it is not very significant compared to, well, even some other predators or humans as a predator, if you will.
Talking to former state DNR Secretary George Meyer, now current head of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, looking at the wolf population, the gray wolf population in Wisconsin, and the wolf hunt back in February and in the future. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Sheboygan Falls. Bill, hi.
Hello. And first, I'd like to say George Meyer is a treasure. He's a wonderful and a continuous asset to wildlife in Wisconsin. So that's the comment. Now, two more comments, really. I'd like to see the wolf hunter shortened, the period of time in which it's legal to hunt wolves. And second, I'd like, along with that, to avoid as much as possible the breeding season. George, I'd appreciate your comments.
Bill, thanks for the call. George, shorter and avoid breeding season, Bill says, for the wolf hunt.
Well, Bill, thank you for the kind remarks. The season that was, and this was not proposed by the DNR. It didn't come from professional biologists. This was set by the legislature with, candidly, very little input from DNR to start. It is a very long season. And clearly from the experiences of the 4 years there's been a hunt, 2012 through 14, which I think the hunt was rough, just a little bit over a month then, that didn't have dog hunting with hounds, that it basically trapping and set hunting by without dogs, that at the most went anywhere from, in some zones, a week or two to 6 weeks at most. And of course this year with the hound season, it was basically a day and a half, 2 day season. So I think there is merit to that there are to the point that the season's too long. Now, from a practical standpoint, though, there if goals are set, the season can be shut off at any time. Now, you have to have the right number of permits issued, not over-issue permits, but it can be controlled by the 24-hour closure period. And that's a technique that can work and did work for 3 years, but you have to have the right amount of permits out there. And the 24-hour closure is something that's used in other seasons. The most known one is that's how the sturgeon season is managed, and that is a very limited harvest species. So statutorily, it's too long, but from a practical standpoint, it should be closed normally way before the breeding period would take place.
Thanks for the call. We've got time for one more caller. Norm is with us in Oneida County. Norm, hello.
Hello. Some of the things I was going to cover are already covered. I'm against the hunting season on wolves. I believe when our settlers first got to Wisconsin, we had between 4,000 and 5,000 wolves. Certainly, they don't expect that today. But the wolf has a necessary and a rightful place in our environment. George mentioned the wolves help keep the deer under control and so on. But I'm trying to say is I'm against the hunting season on wolves.
Norm, thanks a lot for the call. George, in our last minute or so, it seems like there's a commitment to making sure we don't lose the wolf again, right? Even if we do have some hunting season?
Definitely. And one thing I'd like to emphasize is hunters don't, and obviously I work with hunting organizations, are not opposed to having wolves in the state. I'm sure there are some, but the great majority of hunters respect the role and the importance of having this species in the state. It's a matter of, like any other species, proper management so that you can have this population within what is a socially acceptable number. And that's what this whole issue is. As you can hear from the public, there's a wide divergence of opinion on what that number is. DNR is going through its development of its wolf management plan. There's a public comment period right now that people can go to the DNR website and take a survey and comment so DNR can get the broad perspective of what should go into that wolf management plan, including population levels.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, George Meyer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, talking about the wolf hunt in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. President Biden says it's time to end America's forever war in Afghanistan. Coming up, we'll look at his plan to withdraw all remaining U.S. troops this summer and look back at the results of the 20-year conflict. Now, for the last year, home has been really important, more so than ever for many people, and that's resulted in some strong profit for stores that sell home stuff. John Menard Jr., founder of Midwestern home improvement chain Menard, saw his net worth grow by $3 billion in one report in the last year. That's one example. Publicly traded stores like Home Depot and Lowe's reported big sales. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 when it comes to home improvement shopping. Do you have a preference on where you shop? Do you have a local hardware store or lumber yard that you go to? Or do you head to the big chains like the Menards, Home Depots, Lowe's, or other chains of the world? Call it at 800-642-1234. Talking about selling stuff, so we're talking to Hart Posen, Professor of Management and Human Resources at the UW School of Business. Hart, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you again.
Some retail sectors not doing so great in the last year. It sounds like home improvement has done pretty well. What are you seeing in this last year?
Well, home improvement has definitely done well. You know, think about it this way. Hundreds of millions of dollars, even billions of dollars, has moved out of sectors of the economy like travel, like restaurant dining. And some of that went back into savings. Some of it went back into making up for lost work and lost jobs. But for lots of people, some of those dollars moved into other kinds of consumption. And home improvement is one big area where that happened.
Now, we've talked, Hart, about trends in other kinds of retail where big chains, Targets and Walmarts and Amazon have taken over so much of the business. Can you talk about the rise of these home improvement big stores, the Home Depot, Menards, Lowe's, that kind of thing? How much concentration has there been in those chains?
you know, those Menards is number three in the country in this business. Home Depot is number one and Lowe's is number two. And Home Depot and Lowe's are both many times Menards' size. Home Depot has almost 2,300 stores compared to Menards' 330-odd stores. You know, over the last number of decades, there's been a tremendous increase in concentration. You know, the day of mom-and-pop hardware stores has mostly passed. Although you see in this mix with Home Depot and Lowe's and Menards as sort of a distant number three, you do see, you know, Ace's, Ace Home Hardware, which are really sort of the modern incarnation of the sort of mom and pop hardware store. And of course, we still do see many regional sort of lumber and other types of players. But clearly what's happened in hardware is the same thing that's happened elsewhere. In fact, you know, it's interesting. Menards was founded in the same year that Walmart was founded, 1962.
Now, Menards
and Walmart dramatically changed its industry, obviously.
Right. Now, Menards has a higher profile here in Wisconsin, but it sounds like that's just because that's where they were started. They have that more regional presence. Forest for the Trees here in Wisconsin, they look bigger maybe than they are nationwide.
Yeah, that's right. So as I said, you know, they have 330 stores around the country. I think Home Depot has almost 300 stores in California alone. Menards is mostly centered in sort of the upper Midwest. They're not 14 or 15 states at the moment. They continue to grow rapidly, but their presence is sort of localized in the upper Midwest.
Talking to Hart Posen, professor of management and human resources at the UW School of Business, talking about the home improvement sector of the retail market. Two really big chains, one less big but more familiar here in Wisconsin. They did big business over the last year. Hart, how has this type of business adapted to online shopping or curbside pickup and that kind of thing?
Well, you know, it's hard. Because Menards is a private company, we have a lot less information on them. But for Home Depot, for instance, their digital sales rose 80% over the past year. And of this 80%, 60% of those orders were picked up at stores. So the players like Home Depot and Lowe's are really pushing big into e-commerce. They have been, but this last year has been a big boon for them. And they're able to sort of capitalize on the e-commerce as a complement to the stores. You know, for many years, starting in the late 90s, people thought of e-commerce as a substitute for brick-and-mortar stores. And what most of the large retailers have found now is that, in fact, it's a complement. They work, you know, if you do more online, it doesn't mean you're going to do less in brick-and-mortar. In fact, you may do more. And you see other firms, you know, famous online, historically online firms like Amazon, jumping into increasingly having a physical presence. And so this has been a big boon for Home Depot and for Lowe's.
Hey, speaking of Amazon, here's a thing where people are making money by selling things to other people. Is this a sector of the retail market that we see Amazon trying to tap into, this home improvement?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in some ways, yes, right? If you need a new kitchen faucet, you can order it on Amazon. If you need nuts and bolts, you can order it on Amazon. If you need lumber, you can't. And you're not going to get the kinds of specialized service and expertise that you'll get at a Lowe's or a Home Depot, or in particular, in my view, at Menards. So Amazon is making some inroads there, but I think there are other retail sectors for whom Amazon is a bigger worry than would be sort of the home improvement sector.
And Hart, you've told me a lot about how if in-person retail is going to survive in many ways, it has to do with the experience the customer has in person. And that thing where you can go to a store, whether it's the big one or that local hardware store, you know, I'm an idiot, so I often need somebody to help me find what I need and how to do it. How important is that as a distinguishing feature of this sector that maybe will be hard for an Amazon to break into?
You know, I completely agree, right? For the experts, they don't need help. But for lots of us, me and you included, we do need help when we go in. And, you know, we do. I go to Menards relatively often. I do count on their expertise and knowledge of what's on the shelf, where it is, and how to use it. And that's very important. The other player you see doing that are Ace and the various local Ace stores around the city. And, you know, I think we tend to go to different places for different things. If I need something really quickly, I'll go to the Ace that's, you know, very close to me. I'll be able to get help to find exactly what I want on the shelf, and it'll be quick and easy. If it's a bigger project, I'm going out to Menards. I also count on and believe I'll get good help and advice there. So it is very important, and I think the importance of the detailed information does play a big role in defending this sector from Amazon, for instance.
I know, Hart, people are watching what's going to happen next with the home improvement sector. And there's a question of, okay, as people can spend their money on travel and restaurants again, hopefully soon, and given that maybe if they were thinking of doing a project, they did it over this last year, is this boom here to stay, or is there going to be a slump now that that demand has been met?
It's always hard to predict the future, right? But Will the level of growth keep up? No, unlikely. But will there be a slump? I don't think that there's going to be a slump. I think something has changed fundamentally, and it is that all of a sudden we've gone from not being able to imagine a world where many of us work from and spend a lot more time at home to all of a sudden not only is this imaginable, but it almost seems likely, and every time we listen to the news and hear about virus variants and everything else, you know, it renews the sense that, boy, this could happen again. And if it happens again, we want our homes to be ready. So I think that there has been, in some sense, a shift in what's possible and what's necessary. And I don't think that's going to stop soon.
It's a good place to leave it. Hart, thanks for joining us again.
Well, thanks for having me. Good to speak with you. And I'm really hoping we'll do this in person next time.
Someday in person, Hart. I'm looking forward to it, too. We're talking to Hart Posen, professor of management and human resources at the UW School of Business. He joined us to talk about booming business for home improvement stores over the last year. Coming up, we'll take a look at President Biden's decision to pull all remaining U.S. troops from Afghanistan over the next 5 months. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. In 5 months, if all goes according to President Biden's plan, all U.S. troops will have been pulled out of Afghanistan and direct U.S. involvement in the 20-year war will be over. Biden made that announcement earlier this week. The drawdown is scheduled to begin on May 1st. That was the deadline for a full withdrawal under a peace agreement the Trump administration had made with the Taliban. Biden said the troops would be home by September 11th. He said it's time for the U.S. to stop pouring resources into an intractable war. More than 2,300 American military personnel have died while serving in Afghanistan. Officially, 2,500 troops are still there. Reaction to the plan has been mixed. Some people saying it's about time. Others worry about the Taliban getting back into power and undoing gains toward democracy and women's rights. Dalia Fahmy is an associate professor of political science at Long Island University at Brooklyn and author of The Rise and Fall of the Muslim Brotherhood. Dalia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What, Dalia, is your reaction to this news, this announcement from the Biden administration?
Well, it's not surprising. We know that this is a deal that was struck under the Trump administration, but this is also a 20-year-long war that spans four different administrations that has taken on very different objectives and trajectories over the past 20 years. You know, if you remember, after the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the United States, the mission in Afghanistan was to oust al-Qaeda and prevent it from using Afghanistan as a safe haven. That was the primary objective. Along with limiting the power of the Taliban. What we're seeing today is the striking of a deal with the Taliban. and in many ways, possibly undermining the presidency and the government of Ashraf Ghani, who met with Secretary Blinken yesterday. You know, in Afghanistan, we really have three parties at play here. You have the government, the U.S.-supported government of Ashraf Ghani. Then you have the Taliban, who, while we were at war with them for so long, have come to the negotiating table, agreeing to no longer strike international forces to be part of the future of Afghanistan. And then, of course, you have the Haqqani Network, which was the insurgent group that fought most of the guerrilla warfare against the United States and NATO forces and the president, Afghan government. So you have three groups of people still vying for power in Afghanistan. Now, the fear is once the U.S. forces leave, that, you know, 10,000 NATO troops, yes, just 2,500 of them would be are the United States. But once they leave, the support for the Afghan government could very quickly collapse. And while our intelligence agencies say that Al-Qaeda and is no longer a threat, and neither is the Taliban, what very recent agencies have said is that this congressionally mandated Afghan study group finds that within 18 months to 3 years, there could be a reconstitution of a terrorist threat in the United States. And so what it's looking is that we haven't learned the lessons of the past, that this troop drawdown could very much indeed create a power vacuum in Afghanistan, which could lead to the reemergence of terrorist groups, because what they have lacked for a very long time, but found in places, certain places like Syria and Iraq, was a physical sanctuary. With the withdrawal of NATO forces, it could very much be that Afghanistan returns to be the physical sanctuary where they could rebuild networks.
I want to give a listen to President Biden in his speech on Wednesday talking about the risk of a resurgence of terrorism in that country. Here's a listen.
We'll reorganize our counterterrorism capabilities and the substantial assets in the region to prevent reemergence of terrorists and the threat to our homeland from over the horizon. We'll hold the Taliban accountable for its commitment not to allow any terrorist to threaten the United States or its allies from Afghan soil. The Afghan government has made that commitment to us as well.
So, Dahlia, how difficult do you think that will be to prevent that reemergence without U.S. troops and NATO allies alongside them in Afghanistan itself?
What we have to remember is that Afghanistan geographically is a very large country, and the government is primarily in the capital of Kabul. They can't really exercise the power of the state throughout all of the territory. And so there already are areas that are uncontrolled. And with a weakened government, with very little support, it could very well be that you have a power vacuum and power infighting that could lead to instability within the next couple of years. But beyond that, we're talking about questions of what is the power of the state versus these networks, and what does it mean for a weakened and failed nation state, especially in its relation to the population? I mean, the critical questions for us come from a security perspective, but what about women and minorities and the future of the Afghan government and what kind of power it's going to hold? Now, these are pressing questions that face not just a weakened country, but also face the United States in terms of what are going to be the long-term threats. We, of course, as a country, are tired of being at war in Afghanistan. And so there is no political will to remain in Afghanistan. But it could be that we are hedging short-term games for long-term security.
Talking to Dahlia Fahmy, Associate Professor of Political Science at Long Island University at Brooklyn, looking at the Biden administration's announcement to withdraw remaining troops from Afghanistan by September of this year. Dahlia, can you talk about the role that U.S. Troops have been playing in Afghanistan in recent years, this much smaller force compared to, you know, tens of thousands at war in previous years? What were the remaining troops doing at this point?
Yeah, I mean, compared to a max of 150,000 troops at one point, and again, you have to remember, over four administrations, over 20 years, our objectives have fundamentally shifted from war to more nation building, to returning to counterterrorism operations, and more recently to capacity enhancement and building and support. And it's that, you know, weak governments often need the umbrella of security to continue to try to forge through on their power. And that's what the United States had been doing, or NATO forces had been doing, striking deals with what was perceived as a very successful council for national reconciliation led by Abdullah Abdullah, who met with Secretary Blinken yesterday as well. And so the support for what would be a coalition governing body to support the Afghan government is what NATO forces were working on primarily. And to see the troop withdrawal, you can see the hesitancy in Afghan leaders of what is this going to mean for them and their support in the long term when they have yet to build the deep governance infrastructure that they need, especially beyond the capital.
I've heard over the years from a couple different administrations now, at least venturing the idea that, okay, if we are there, if American troops are there, we're in effect being a crutch that the Afghan government can rely on. At some point, we have to withdraw so that they can take on these capabilities themselves. Was there anything to those arguments, do you think?
That would happen in a perfect world. And yes, while there is an element to that, we're talking about taking a chance on not just instability, but a power vacuum that could return within, according to our own intelligence services, within 18 months to 3 years. And so while, yes, they do need to at some point stand on their feet, because it has not been enough time for this governance structure to work. You know, you have to remember the interim president, Hamid Karzai, was removed more recently. So this is a new president that doesn't have a strong foothold in the power dynamic within the country, but also is still facing what used to be a party, the Taliban, not on the political platform, but since about a year and a half ago, they're striking a deal. They've reemerged as a political player. Now, on one hand, it's good to have them at the negotiation table. On the other hand, they are actually more powerful than the government itself. And so drawdown is good if it leads to stability. And we might be taking a gamble here that could create power infighting that would lead to long-term instability.
Dolly, I want to take our last minute and a half or so with your thoughts, your concerns for the people of Afghanistan with this pullout after wars going back to the 70s, the Civil War, the Soviet invasion, Civil War again, the U.S. presence there. What are you worried about for the Afghan people now?
I most worry about their inability over the past 40 years, but really during the past 20 years, to build a strong civil society. Afghanistan has a long legacy of intelligence and art and media and women's rights, especially up until the 1960s and 70s. Since the Soviet invasion, there's been a regression and there hasn't been a time period allowed for the building of a strong civil society that protects the rights of women and girls especially. And while our secretary, spokesperson of the Secretary of State Department, Ned Pierce, did mention that this would be part of the U.S. long-term strategic growth in the region, the drawdown really puts women in a precarious situation. And we've heard interviews coming out of Afghanistan in the past couple of days where women especially are concerned, not just about their future, but the future of their daughters, where the Taliban have already begun to close schools.
And briefly, Dahlia, what are you watching for between now and September with the pullout of these troops?
I'm watching for how the Taliban is going to negotiate its peace in the government, how strong the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, is going to be, and will both of them be able to keep at bay the Haqqani network that's still waiting for its foothold of power that it had not gotten in the past 20 years.
Dahlia, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Dahlia Fahmy is an associate professor of political science at Long Island University at Brooklyn, author of the book The Rise and Fall of the Muslim Brotherhood. We talked to her about President Biden's decision to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 8, visit Wisconsin's forests and find out about the latest efforts to protect the state's forest ecosystems. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a political scientist analyzed 14 years' worth of traffic stops. She joins the show to talk about her findings on racial disparities and who gets pulled over and who gets searched further when they do. That's coming up next. Remember, you can follow all our conversations here on the Ideas Network, not just on your radio. You can listen online at WPR.org, where you can also find lots and lots of archived shows on just about any topic, including our Food Friday conversations with lots of recipes from years past at WPR.org/Food Friday. Also, get the Wisconsin Public Radio app and listen wherever your phone or other device is. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.